Good evening, everyone, and thank you for listening to the Futurati podcast, where we dive into how emerging technologies will impact the world and your bank accounts. I'm Trent Fowler, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Thomas Fry. Thomas and I are futurists, keynote speakers, and consultants with decades of experience in analyzing trends and communicating new developments to audiences across the world. Reach out to us at futuratipodcast.com/contact-futurati if you'd like to hire us for consulting, to speak at your event, or to advertise on our podcast. Thomas, we just wrapped up a wonderful interview with philosophy professional Dr. Gregory Salmieri, and it was a very wide-ranging conversation where we talked about artificial intelligence and property rights and concept formation and epistemology and a thousand other things. Was there anything that stood out as especially worthwhile to you?
I think just the process, the way his mind works, is that he'll take a very complicated topic and he'll just peel apart the onion layers and get at what actually are you asking? What's going on here? And I found that to be quite fascinating because we hit him up with some pretty unusual questions that he just dove right in, and you kind of see how his mind works in thinking through these type of issues. I found that totally fascinating.
I did as well. I'm a longtime fan of Dr. Salmieri's for that particular reason. He's just very good at saying, okay, well, we're using this word. It can mean at least three different things. Let's parse that down. What facts support each interpretation? How do we apply those in different contexts? Like, how would you know when you've gone beyond where it's an appropriate application of a given idea? He's very, very good at that. And I've listened to him on podcasts for years and read his articles and listened to him in debates and conversations. And that's always struck me as being a special strength of his, is his ability to kind of parse it down to fundamentals and build back up to an understanding where at the end you just feel like you have a lot more clarity.
Right, right. Very much so.
In the conversation, you know, as we said, for me, I think two of the standouts were his approach to validating concepts that are important in the philosophy of artificial intelligence. So like, what do we mean by intelligence? What do we mean by something being alive? How do you know that it's alive? How do you know it's conscious? He really has a fantastic framework for thinking through those things. And then also property rights as applied to emerging technology. So if you don't know the danger of something, how do you regulate it? Should you regulate it at all? Is that even appropriate? Like, when do your neighbors have a right to ask you to stop doing something? But I thought those were two of the highlights in particular.
Yeah. When I posed that scenario of AI having its own bank account with $1 million in it, how would it know what to spend it on? The way he answered that, I thought was just brilliant. And so in case you want to find out more about it, just listen to the podcast here.
Yeah, listen to the podcast. You can also find Dr. Salmieri on Twitter. So without further ado, here is our interview with Dr. Salmieri. Tonight, we're joined by Dr. Gregory Salmieri. Dr. Salmieri is a senior scholar of philosophy at Salem Center, where he holds the Brigham Fellowship for the Study of Objectivism. Dr. Salmieri is the co-editor of the books The Companion to Ayn Rand and Foundations of a Free Society, and he's the author of numerous articles on philosophy with a particular focus on Aristotle and Ayn Rand. If you enjoy this interview, please subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends, and don't forget to check out our website, futuratipodcast.com. Greg, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's hear a little bit about your background, your interests, and what brought you working on the problems that you're working on today.
Oh, well, the problems I'm working on today are a bit eclectic. I'm working on a piece on free speech. I'm working on editing a book on Aristotle and Ayn Rand. I have a bunch of essays on values and the nature of valuing. How did I get into that? Well, in graduate school, I was mostly studying Aristotle. I was studying him because I wanted a philosopher that I really admired and looked up to and thought that I could learn to from a lot as a main focus of my work in graduate school. And there weren't living philosophers who I thought that way about. And I thought if I become an Aristotle scholar, like my professors will in effect be like Aristotle's TAs, and I'm mostly learning from him. And I did learn a lot from Aristotle and from my professors, and, you know, wrote some on Aristotle, and still I'm doing a little of that, but I've transitioned to writing a lot on Ayn Rand, who is someone I was interested in from the early days of my interest in philosophy, and now trying to write more on directly on philosophical issues where my views are, you know, inspired by these two figures and others who I've read and written on, but not exegesis of them so much as.
So in what areas did Aristotle and Ayn Rand actually intersect?
Well, intersect is a little hard. She really admired his metaphysics, not everything about it, but the idea that things are what they are, that you could understand causality in terms of the natures of entities, and that there's a kind of deep knowledge centered around causal connections and definitions that one can form starting from the senses. And it's a lot of my work in Aristotle has been kind of trying to understand that aspect of him, his view about how we reach universal knowledge starting from perception, his view about how we discover causes. So that those are kind of, you know, where my head was. But I've also written a fair amount about his ethics, and there are similarities and differences between Rand's ethics and Aristotle's as well, which I've been more on about recently.
Could you say a little bit about the causal connections and the definitions? Because I feel like that would be good context going into all the questions I have about consciousness and intelligence and AI.
Well, there's this, you might call it classical conception of science, which you find bits of it in Plato, most clearly articulated in Aristotle, and then held by almost all significant thinkers until about the time of Hume, in which the kind of model of what a completed science would look like is something like Euclid's Elements. So there's the idea that we knew, of course, and the Greeks knew, most of the theorems proved in Euclid's Elements far before the proofs for them were worked out in detail. But you kind of systematize it. Here are the fundamental facts. These are the definitions of all the terms involved. Here are the fundamental entities existing in the area that we're studying that you don't need to explain why they exist, but you're going to explain other things in terms of them. And then from those definitions and those fundamental principles of the field, combined with some general axioms that apply to everything or to broader fields of which this one is a part, you explain why various other things are true. And the definitions are the kind of principles that help you, some of the principles that help you do that, and some of the other ones are just knowing which kind of entities in the field or phenomena in the field are kind of unexplained explainers, kind of basic fundamental facts or primary. And you can see that kind of conception of science assumed in the titles of many of the classic works of science. For example, Newton wrote a Principia, a set of principles about mathematical principles about motion. Francis Bacon, who was in some ways a critic of Aristotle, and I think some of his criticisms are correct, is nonetheless thinking about how is it that we reach principles, and how do we define things rightly, define the principles, how do we discover what the causal connection between things are. So there's this kind of this general conception of science, which has, and you still see it even in John Locke, and as well as in the rationalists, the early modern philosophers, Spinoza and people like that. But it is kind of thrown over in the kind of Humean empiricist tradition, which is a kind of revival of a sort of skeptical tradition that was started in ancient Greek medicine. And I'm not sure where how much more you want me to say about this, where to go with it. But the general idea is that this kind of knowledge where we can see about things, why they are, how they are, it's not just a bunch of patterns. I think the real difference is, does knowledge let us, is it possible to have a science in which we grasp what things are and therefore why they act in the way they do and have to act in that way? If they're turned out to be exceptions, we can understand why they're exceptions and why they have to be exceptions, as opposed to just, in effect, becoming better or worse at predicting patterns of appearances. And that's what the Greek empiric doctors thought was all knowledge should be, at least in medicine. And it's in effect what David Hume thinks knowledge can be. You just predict patterns. You become a better and better predictor of patterns of appearances, but without any understanding of why the appearances are that way.
But that line of argument has always kind of struck me as amazing. Like how could you, like, what's the best way to predict the patterns more accurately? It's to understand the identities of the things that are acting, their causal interconnections, and like how those might change into the future. It's like, obviously that's how you would arrive at the clearest understanding, or at least it seems that way to me.
Well, maybe what you're looking for is clear understanding, but there are things that predict fairly well without doing that. I think we can find some of those systems in ourselves. And you wanted to talk at some point about AI, and I think LLMs are examples of a technology that's proven really good at predicting certain kinds of things, but without, so far as anybody knows or can tell, having any kind of understanding of them. I don't think it's the kind of thing that could have understanding of them, but I also don't think it's simulating deep down understanding of them. It's simulating patterns of word uses, as far as I can tell now in picture.
Yeah, well, that's an almost perfect segue, as if you set that up for me. So I did want to talk about artificial intelligence and get your perspective as somebody who's thought a lot in particular about epistemology, because I think that's where we have to begin if we're going to try to understand these phenomena. And I can't say for certain, but I believe it was on a panel when you were in Greece last year where you said that LLMs aren't conscious and you didn't think they're the kinds of things that can be conscious. So I'm a machine learning engineer by training. I've thought a lot about philosophy of mind. It's not obvious to me they couldn't be conscious. So I'm very interested in what theoretical backing is going into that statement. Like how do you think about that? How would you know? How do you look for that? How would you even assess that?
Well, we come up with the idea of consciousness by observing it in ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And then we infer that other things have it, that are like ourselves. And, I infer that you have it because I know in pretty much every way you're like me, your biology is like me, you do things like me. This isn't the point about how well I know you and how we're like two peas in a pod, but you're the same species of thing as me. You nod your head when you hear things said. And so you behave like me and you have parts and components like me and we're made in the same way I was made. So it stands to reason that when you act in ways very much like I act, it's due to causes very much like the ones I can observe in myself causing it. And it's that same kind of argument that makes us think that animals are conscious. And I think it's a good argument. It gets weaker and weaker the further the things that we're talking about are from human beings, right? And so if you say, like, is a snail conscious? I don't know. A clam, or whatever, or even an insect. And also, it not only gets weaker in that we're less sure that the conclusion is true, it also gets a little less clear what it would be like for a creature like that to be conscious. I assume that what it's like to be you is more or less like what it's like to be me. I assume that what it's like to be a dog is quite a bit different than that, but that it's broadly the same, like they look around and they have a visual field and things, or they smell things, they smell them much more intensely and whatever. But I can kind of think about what things I would have to modify about what my inner life are like to get something that would be like yours, and then further to get something that would be more like a dog's. The further we get away from creatures whose behavioral repertoire is like us and whose biology is like us, the more creative we have to be in imagining what it must be like to be them, and the less certain I think we can be that we're right, that and the more vague in general our sense of what their inner lives would be like.
Recently,
or not, we just don't know.
So last week Peter Diamandis was asking the question of what's AI going to be like when it's actually a trillion times smarter than humans? And I keep going back to this idea that the AI intelligence is far different than human intelligence. And so it's not an apples to oranges question that you can be asking. So how would you describe the difference between human intelligence and AI?
I'm not even clear that I would call, but I think it's in an extended sense of intelligence that we call AI intelligent. It's not wrong to do it, but it's like when you say that the computer has a memory. Well, does it have the same thing you have when you have a memory? We form the concept memory based on ourselves and on animals, and the computer has something that's analogous to it, and that's an important analogy that aids us in remembering that we have the computer to store things for, in the same way that paper can have memories or in a different way, you start magnets having a memory. What do we mean when we say that the computer has intelligence? Well, we mean it can do a lot of the kinds of work that we accomplish by our intelligence. But we don't know In some cases, we do know how it's doing it, and we know that it's very different from how we're doing it. And in other cases, we don't quite know how it's doing it, except in a very generalized way. And because of that, I don't think... So we'd have to think about particular cognitive or cognitive assisting or mirroring like abilities it has, how we think it does them. And then the question is, what will its intelligence be like? Well, there are two questions, I think, there that can be run together. One is like, what will it be like to be it? What will its conscious experience be like? What kind of a, you know, guy will it be and so forth in terms of its inner life? And I think the answer is, as far as we know, no kind. It won't have an inner life unless it's something very different than the kind of things we have now. Or you might mean like, how will it behave in the world? What kind of things will it do? What sort of solutions to questions you put into it will it output? What sort of ways will it drive cars or whatever? And that, I think, is a kind of technological question that we need to look at the particular technologies and how they work to know the answer to. I don't have any insight into that as a philosopher, except to say that we should be wary of uncritically porting over human concepts to it and thinking things like, you know, I don't know. People who are very intelligent often have social irregularities of this or that sort and niche interests. Will Watson 10.0 or ChatGPT 19 be like that? I think that's like not a question that really makes sense to ask.
Yeah. So I think it's an interesting question that if AI has its own bank account, let's say it has $1 million in its own bank account, how will it decide what to spend the money on? What choices will it make? Well, I think it would actually survival things. It would want to have the power going to it, and it would want to have maintenance and repair functions that repair it. But after that, I mean, it's not like it wants to buy a car.
What would make you think it would even want to be maintained? Like, does ChatGPT now want that? What technology are we imagining?
That's a good question. I guess I'm viewing it through a human lens as to the first thing we look for is to survive. And that might be wrong to attribute that motive to AI.
But once you have a thing that is trying to survive and or that has any other motive, I think you have something that's very different from any of the technologies we have now that we're calling AI. Like the thing that drives a Tesla car or the thing in my cheaper Hyundai Sonata, which keeps it staying in the same lane while it's on cruise control, or ChatGPT. None of these things have goals in the sense that a human being has them. I guess you could say the car as the goal of staying in the same lane. But if you gave that car $1 million, it wouldn't, you know, like invest in new lane changing. It wouldn't do anything. It would just not spend the money and keep going straight in the lane, right? Until it was programmed to do something with that money on some standard. If you gave ChatGPT $1 million, it wouldn't do anything with it. It would just sit in the bank account unless there was like a plug-in put to it and you sold it like, book me some airline tickets, and then it would, and try to get the best deal or whatever, and then it would book cheap airline tickets with $1 million. So it, right now, it's only, the only things that are analogous to motives, and I don't really even think they should be called motives, are just what instructions it's given. And if we want to know for future things like this, what kind of motives they have, I think the question lies in how they're designed and what questions they're given. Now, you could imagine something that does have its own motives. It's a lot more like an animal. But once you have a technology like that, it's just a very different kind of technology than any of the things that are being built now and are being called AI. It could well be that it's powered or enabled by them. Like you build a robot and you give the robot ChatGPT so it can talk and you give it, you know, some image recognizing thing. But the thing that would make it more like an animal is that it's designed to try to sustain itself and maybe perpetuate its kind. But like, there are plenty of things that do that in the world, you know, made by nature, not by us, that nobody thinks it was intelligent at all, like plankton, right? So plankton is alive, And plankton wouldn't have anything to do with $1 million because, but it's alive and it goes about planktoning and so forth and plants. And so there are these kinds of things, and they don't have anything that's like, that we would think of as like intelligence, except in the sense that they have genetic programs that they execute and so forth. If you imagine, so like that element, I think is missing now from anything that we are calling AI. If you build something artificially that's like a piece of plankton or like a fly or an ant or something that goes around the world with a goal of sustaining itself, then what you've created isn't an artificial intelligence. The thing might be really dumb. You've created an artificial life. And then once you've created an artificial life, you could think about what kind of goals it has and so forth that are all, you'd be drawing on your knowledge of biology to that because you will have created a new life form. And we could now probably bioengineer some new life forms. I think, you know, viruses and things which are borderline alive, but we could engineer, and maybe we could engineer some bacteria or something soon, right? So you can engineer literal life forms, presumably made out of the same stuff life forms are made of. And maybe it's possible to engineer things that are like life forms, and it'll be borderline whether to call them life forms or not at first, but that are made out of silicon or glass or rubber or metal or whatever, instead of made out of the stuff we're made out of. All of that is separate from building something smart, right? But you could imagine having built something like that, then trying to build into it something like the things we now call AIs as part of the technologies that they have to accomplish the goals that they have. And then if you do that, then you're getting something that would be more like an artificial human being. And then you can start wondering what it'll do with the $1 million you put in its bank account, or how it might hack into your bank account and get your $1 million or whatever. But I think you need to think of it as like, are we building something like life? Here's another analogy, and I'm going to kind of like shamelessly go to sci-fi here, because everybody's thinking about AI as just science fiction. All of the worries about it are just people who've seen Terminator. All of the hopes for it are people who've seen other things. So like, we're all just, you know, maybe pretending to do other things, but just kind of riffing on various sci-fi things we've seen. And so if you think about Star Trek, right, there's the Star Trek computer, the shipboard computer, and there's Data. All the things that have been done over the past, you know, several years that are so impressive, what OpenAI is doing and so forth, are all incremental moves towards the Star Trek computer. They're not moves towards Data. Now, presumably you'd need to have kind of Star Trek computer building technology to build the Data. So in that sense, they are. But we're not like asymptotically approaching Lieutenant Commander Data, basically a person who's made out of silicon, right? And if you think about the things that you can do with, like, they don't really quite work very well yet, but they're getting there with Claude or with GPT-4 and hopefully more with GPT-5. They're the kinds of things you could do with the Star Trek computer. You know, show me a picture, you know, a picture of this planet. Okay, now make it dimmer. Now, what would it look like if there was a building there? And now write a sonnet about this and so forth. And these are the kind of things you see them doing with the computer all the time. No, that's a little bit, you know, make it more this way, make it more that way. That's the kind of technology we've got, and it's awesome, right? And hopefully it'll get a lot better. But it's not, there's no sense in which the shipboard computer is alive. And there is in that fictional universe, right, these other electronic things that are alive, the things like Data. And I think, and then there are also in some episodes, like, you know, little microbe-like things that are alive that are made of computer parts. So I think that distinction is a helpful one. We're building tools now like the computer. We're not building things like living things, and maybe we eventually will. There are robots being built, but even the robots being built are being built as relatively single-purpose tools, right? Not as things that are on about trying to sustain themselves. And I don't think there's any amount of building the tool-like thing that will just make it become a lifelike thing, a kind of thing that's trying to sustain itself. I think that's just a different project. And it may be a project that can be done if someone has a reason to do it, but it's just a different one. Things are calculating or predicting, that's not going to make them come alive.
Hello, this is Trent Fowler, co-host of the Futurati podcast. One of the most common pieces of marketing advice I've come across is to know your audience and give them what they want. One difficulty in podcasting is that it's actually pretty hard to do this. None of the major platforms give us any way to reach out to you, our listeners, to find out what you enjoy about the Futurati podcast and what you'd like to see done differently. So we've decided to record this commercial and ask you directly to reach out to us. Head over to FuturatiPodcast.com, go to the contact page, and drop us a line. Tell us about your favorite and least favorite episodes, what you'd like to see us cover in the future, and anything else you want us to know. We produce this show for you, and we want your advice so we can make it even better. Thank you.
So if you actually created a flesh bot that had some pieces of human-like brain, then we're starting to cross that barrier. Is that what you're saying then?
Not even that, but it's not really even about what it's made of. Like you could presumably, suppose you were able to take neurons and use them like chips. And you took a bunch of neurons out of a human brain. I've seen people are doing this with rat neurons and experimenting with them. But suppose you were able to take a bunch of human neurons, maybe human stem cells or whatever, and develop them into neurons and hook them up into a neural net. And you were basically able to recreate the x86 architecture out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. What you'd have is a wet x86 that would do what an x86 computer would do and whatever. It would be... I don't know if this is possible, right? But if it were possible, it would be simply a regular computer made out of different kinds of stuff that would do the kinds of things regular computers can do. To make a living thing, you'd have to design it or let it get evolved to be designed to be in the business of sustaining itself and of forming goals in order to sustain itself. And it might be that something that can do that can only be made out of the stuff that living things are made of, or it might be that it could be made out of silicon too. But the project of designing something like that, what it would be to design something like that, is a lot different than the project of what it would be to making a in effect, general purpose calculating machine.
Do you have any thoughts on the idea that agency might emerge through the process of training these grander tools? You said that building just successively better tools doesn't at any point cross over to Event Horizon where it becomes a project of building a living thing. But I think the doomer counter argument would be that, well, the original general intelligence, human beings emerged out of a blind selection process, which doesn't look all that different from the cost minimization stuff we do when training a large language model. We've had some guests that have done a pretty good job of punching back on that, but yeah,
out of a selection process of something that's in the context of something that was alive and trying to survive, right? And I'm not saying you couldn't conceivably get something that's conscious and intelligent and all the things we are out of some process like that. And I'm not even saying you couldn't do it out of some process like that where the medium of it is silicon rather than flesh. But what I'm saying is we're not involved in anything like a process like that.
Interesting. Okay, I like that answer. I wanted to give you some space to riff on a couple of concepts that I see people sliding between quite often, and you don't have to do all four, but the four I notice are agency, aliveness, consciousness, and intelligence. And I don't expect you to improvise a full inductive validation of those ideas, but what if you were trying to arrive at a much firmer definition of intelligence or agency, how might you proceed to do that? What would you like? How would you line up instances? How might you come up with a genus and a differentia?
One of the I won't call it a difficulty here, but one of the things to be aware of in any case like this is that oftentimes concepts are formed analogously, and it's good to form concepts analogously and to have concepts like that. And so a lot of these concepts are involved in things like that. There's some options as to which sense of it we're using and how we're using it. But basically, life, I think, is the was life, agency, what were the other two, consciousness and intelligence?
Yep, those are the four.
Right. So the way I think of it is life is, I'll use Rand's definition, a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. But the idea of it is that if you look at the entities that are around, some of them are such that there's something they're always busy doing, that if they stop doing that, they can't resume doing it. And what that thing is a process of keeping themselves going, of pursuing, taking actions which result in the creations of conditions, which conditions are needed for them to carry on existing as things that take on those actions. And these things, all or almost all, are also involved in propagating their kind in one way or another. I say all or almost all because some propagate at the species level, some individual, and so forth. That's what life is. It's this process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. And we think about it not just as what is life in the abstract, but there's a difference between living things and dead things. So you start by noticing about human beings and large animals, I mean large, you know, macroscopic visible animals, that they move around in the world, they make noise, they eat things. If they don't do that, they die, which means they stop doing that and they rot and start smelling and so forth. And then later you discover that things like trees are actually doing the same thing, but they move way more slowly. And you know, they grow, all these things grow, and the tree could die too, and then the shape is there. And, you know, this is something you can understand as a child, and human beings did come to understand. And that is what, you know, life and a living thing is. Then consciousness. Consciousness is an attribute of some living things. We can wonder about whether it's possible for anything non-living to have it, but as we find it in the world, and I think as for all we have reason to believe, it's an attribute of living things, so far only of living things, that serves a role in their process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. And I don't think it's exactly definable, because I think we know it in our own case, and it's a kind of fundamental concept that you can't sort of get behind, but you form it by thinking what's in common between seeing, touching, tasting, smelling, thinking, desiring, itching, wanting. There's a kind of what it's like to be these things. There's an awareness, and I think awareness is the kind of fundamental form of the concept consciousness. So the word consciousness could mean I'm conscious of something, I'm aware of something, or it could mean the faculty by which I'm aware of something, which might have other things that it does besides being aware, like wanting, desiring, dreaming, making believe, and so forth. But it's this kind of widening from these various states we observe in ourselves, seeing, smelling, touching, tasting, dreaming, waking, etc. So that's what consciousness is. It's fundamentally awareness of the world, but that's just a synonym for it, so it's not a definition. And it's the faculty of awareness with all its all the other features and abilities that faculty has. It's a faculty had by living things by which they direct their actions, the actions which are part of this process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. So that's what consciousness is. And then agency and intelligence were the other two. Mm-hmm. So agency, I think, can mean multiple things. You want to think about, do I mean what's in common between human beings and animals, or even all plants? Like, the very general sense of the word agency, which I don't really think like using the word this way, but there's some sense to it, is agency is the feature of living things whereby they're able to generate action. You talked about self-generated action and that ability to generate action from its own source of energy directed towards the purpose of sustaining itself just is agency. And you can see the word being used this way in some writing now. There's a book, Free Agents, by Kevin Mitchell, which I think has some very good features. Some parts of it I disagree with strongly, but I think it's a really interesting book. And you could see him talking about agency at the level of, you know, microbes even, just meaning that they're able to generate action. But you might, on the other extreme, or you might in the middle, think of agency as consciously generated action. And you might think that what plants do isn't consciously generated. Consciousness is a faculty of human beings and a faculty of animals like dogs and cats, and very probably a faculty of, you know, that bees and insects have, and maybe a faculty that worms have. And we said before how there's a little bit of, you know, but however far down it goes, those organisms have it. And maybe you mean by agency, the generating and directing of action by that process. Or you can mean by agency, and this is how I'm inclined to use the word, the specific kind of directing of action that's distinctive to human beings, whereby we originate goals. I don't think other living creatures do that. That's something we could talk about. And if that's what we mean by agency, that's a much narrower thing. That, again, so far, only human beings, I think there's any reason to believe, do that. Then intelligence. What do we mean by intelligent? Well, one thing, there are multiple things one might measure. Intelligence is supposed to be something measurable that goes on a continuum. So there's a sense in which you could use it, I suppose, to say, like, are dogs more intelligent than cats or vice versa? Are bunnies more or less intelligent than dolphins? I think there are measures that people use for this. I'm not sure what they are, but whatever that is measuring, right? Some kind of cognitive ability to problem solve or something, I'm not sure. But you'd want to think about, what are people measuring when they're saying things like that? Is there a trait there that's valid to measure? And is it even all the same thing they're measuring across things? Then there's, you know, human intelligence, which is the, you want to think about what is distinctive about human beings. And I think what's distinctive about human beings is our consciousness works in a very different way. We share the faculty of sense perception with those animals that have it. But I think we have a faculty of reasoning, which is a distinct faculty of forming concepts, of the faculty involved being able to be self-critical, being able to set self-direct on a wide scale. And it involves not having preset automatic goals, but rather being able to originate goals for ourselves. And I think these are all aspects of the faculty of reason. And intelligence, as we use it in the human case, which I think the primary meaning of the word, is something like the ability of the degree of one's ability to reason. I don't think it's a very well-defined concept in terms of, you know, measure. There are IQ tests and things, and they're sort of all right-ish as psychological, you know, metrics go, but no psychological metrics are that good, and I don't think it's really been well conceptualized what we're measuring.
So since you're something of an expert on Socrates,
Aristotle,
Socrates,
if we brought Aristotle alive today in our world, what are the things that he would most focus on with the world as it stands right now?
I mean, I always find these kind of questions about when you take a thinker from another period. You know, he'd have to learn some language because nobody speaks classical Greek anymore. And there'd be a lot of disorientation, right? And I think how he processed all the surprising things that he saw that, nobody from his time could have predicted or anticipated would depend a lot on, you know, we can't say how a genius encountered with a reality that's different than anything he could have imagined in terms of what human beings can do. And what we've discovered, what questions he'd then form and ask. But I could say some of the things that I think would be very surprising to him, that I think would get him thinking whatever he'd come up with about them. So the first one is, I think Aristotle and the Greeks in general thought there was a lot less knowledge to be had in principle than we think there is. Like, they seem to think, like, we finished geometry. We're a couple of years from finishing three-dimensional geometry. We've almost got astronomy, and a generation or two will have it. And, you know, then we'll know how the world works, basically. We've worked out how to farm, and we're pretty good at potting. Maybe somebody will create a better pot. You know, like, they didn't have the idea that knowledge continue progressing indefinitely. And they thought of sciences as completable, and many of them as completed. So just the idea that, like, boy, we thought we knew how to farm, and we were better than those nomads who didn't know how to farm. But, like, people in the 17th century were farming way different than we did. And then now you've had a green revolution in the 20th century, and you can make way more food from way less land. Like, just the idea that there have been so many times when the frontiers of knowledge have been pushed forward, that you have the sense that either there's a never-ending amount of more things to know, or at least you can't really be and shouldn't really be defining knowledge with respect to how close we get to omniscience. And I think, I mean, for Plato, like, you didn't have real knowledge of anything, I think, until you were omniscient. Omniscient in the sense of omniscient, knowing all the things that were scientifically knowable. Until that point, everything was only, like, tentative. I don't think Aristotle quite has that view, but there's still the idea that you have a sense of what a fully completed science would be. And then you measure what you've got. And a fully completed science would be one which is like, there's nothing more to learn. We know it all. And then you measure where you are with an eye to how close you are to that completed thing. And I think it's just very implausible to think about science that way anymore. Although I do think a lot of people still do think of it that way. I don't think it's really tenable. So I think how he dealt with the realization that either isn't a tenable way to think about science at all, or if it is, your thought about how close we are to the end of it would be astonishing. And there'd be a lot of thinking about how to rethink about knowledge and the inquiry process in light of that. And then connected to that, I think something that is really central to Aristotle and to Plato is the fascination with understanding underlying causes and systematizing knowledge in the way that Euclid systematizes geometrical knowledge, and in the way that trying to reduce the motions that are visible in the heavens to a notion, to the motions of a relatively small number of relatively simple geometrical shapes. They were trying to do it with just circles. We've since learned you need ellipses. But the idea that you can like come up with it. So it's not just a whole lot of stars are moving around and some of them wander and so forth. But, you know, there are this many simple shapes that can explain all the motion. They were really fascinated with that project. They saw that kind of project, again, the same in geometry and some other things, as really that's what it's like to understand. That's what it's like to be fully human. You're grasping why and how things are the way they are. But they didn't see that as practical. They didn't see that as being a kind of thing that could put bread on the table, that could feed you, that could have, like, maybe occasionally there would be useful things that would come out of it on the side, but they didn't see it as, like, fundamentally connected to enabling us to accomplish the business of surviving better. And it's not so much that they were resistant to the idea that it could, although to some extent Aristotle was, but it's primarily just like, you know, like, suppose we work out that there were 57 circles and there's one prime mover, like, how is that going to help? What are you going to do with that? There's nothing they thought you could do with something like that except wonder about it. But now, you know, you can get to the moon and bring stuff back. And again, you can, you know, bioengineer a vaccine and all these kinds of things. Like, it turns out all kinds of things in higher mathematics and so forth that seemed like they were just worth doing because they were interesting turn out to give you life-changing power. I think that realization is something that would really have shaken up Aristotle. And that combined with the idea that there's, you know, possibly more and more knowledge to get forever, or at least way more than you could imagine doing in the foreseeable future, would really, I think, taking those ideas into account, I think you really need to refactor Aristotelian thinking. And the question of how Aristotle himself would have done it, I don't know. And then for Aristotle, the other thing that just because he was so so much of a biologist, the fact of evolution, not just the fact of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection, which I think we know to be true, but also just the kind of fact of the fossil record and so forth, that it hasn't always been the same species forever, as Aristotle thought. I think just how to understand and think about that fact and integrate that to the rest of his thinking would have been, you know, something that would have been endlessly fascinating. Yeah.
Are you enjoying this episode of the Futurati podcast? If so, please like it, give the show a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and share it with your friends. By far, the best way to help us grow is to spread the word on social media, which will expose our content to more people and help us continue to bring you interviews with world-leading experts in AI, quantum computing, cryptocurrencies, and so much more. Thank you in advance.
Yeah, but too bad we can't run that experiment. I've seen visualizations of Aristotle where they take the statues and they put a face on it, and I looked at him and said, that guy would have a podcast. He definitely would be a podcaster. Aristotle, the original podcaster. So there's something I've wanted to talk to an actual trained epistemologist on for a while. You mentioned, you know, knowledge and how it accumulates. And I wonder if you've given any thought to Bayesian epistemology, because I know this is super, super popular among doomers and among like a particularly bright clique of people who are thinking about these things. But I've always had reservations about it, but didn't really know how to get into it. So what do you think about it?
Yeah. So I wouldn't say I'm at all an expert in it, although I've read about it and thought about it. There are the sort of general error I think that people make of taking a technology, a crude technology for modeling something, which crude technology may be a major advance on not being able to model that thing at all, and may make you understand that thing sort of better than you did before and give you more control over it and let you improve, you know, your whole thinking about it, right? But confusing that crude technology for modeling the thing with the thing being modeled itself. And I think that's going on with a lot of the thinking in statistics and a lot of the kind of, a lot of what Peck is called Bayesian epistemology, where people think they're doing when they're calling themselves Bayesians. What are the ideas? Well, I'll give some that are kind of simpler than Bayesianism first. So just the idea that you can multiply probabilities and you get a smaller probability, but you multiply probability, and you need to do that when you're thinking about the conjunction of things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like if it's this probable that X will happen and this probable that Y will happen, well, then it's the, you know, multiplication of those two things, which is smaller, that X and Y will happen together. Like, that's a fact that we can specify mathematically if you assign numbers to probabilities, which you can't really assign numbers to probabilities in most cases, but there are a few kind of cases where you can. And in those cases, you can notice that this property holds true. And then you could generalize that to, well, suppose we, for the sake of argument, assigned a vague number to the probability of this thing or of that thing, and that pattern is going to have to hold, right? Like, I don't know how likely it is that Biden will win the presidency and the re-election, and I don't know how likely it is that it will be thundering on the day he takes office, but I know that it's less likely that he'll win and it will be thundering than either of those two things are, like, singly, right? So that's just a kind of very simple thing that you might first notice as a result of, you know, doing some stats, right? Probability theory. That is an important thing to notice, and then you can port to cases where you can't put numbers on it. Here's some others that you can have a prior probability of something, how likely you think something is going into it, and then you can update that in light of things that you find, right? So it's not just the idea of a prior and updating. I think that is a valid idea, and it's an important idea, but there's cases where you can do it mathematically, where you could literally assign numbers to things, and you have some grounds for assigning those numbers to them. Like, you know, whatever, you're picking a random ball out of a jar, and you know that there are 100 balls in the jar, and that one of them is white or whatever. You know you have a 1 in 100 odds of picking a white ball, and you could set up these kinds of things. So you're shuffling a random deck of cards, and then if you're prior that, you know, his hand is has a pair of jacks in it, which you can work out what that prior is just by the math, right? Then he does this thing which somebody wouldn't do with a pair of jacks, so it's now less likely or whatever. And you can think about all of that in kind of the theory of simple games. There's something right about the math. The math about what you can do in those cases is right. And there's also something informative about how thinking works in general about that math. It's a kind of simplified, almost toy, although there are cases where you could literally apply it, so it's not just a toy, but very simplified, special case of how thinking works, from which you can learn, you can induce some more general lessons. But I think the general lessons are often induced in a kind of frozen abstraction way from the concretes of statistical, what you can do with a statistical method. It's like, in effect, you should assign priors to all your beliefs. And then you should test them that way. Well, how are you going to assign these priors? Whatever you feel like, or just whatever seems right to you. I don't think you can really do that. Or if you think about the guy who wrote Erastru Codex 10, whose name I'm
about. Alexander,
and also the woman who wrote Scout Mindset.
Julie
Galen, yeah. Talk about, trying to quantify all your predictions and test, and then see, like, do the things that you think have a 1 in 3 shot happen about 1 in 3 times. There's something plausible about doing that, but most, it treats our, what we think as too much of a black box. It's too Popperian, in effect. You have ideas, God knows where you got them from, and there's no rationality to how you get them, but they may be accompanied by a sense of how strong or not the ideas are. And then you just kind of falsify them, and then you try to, by finding which ones falsify and which ones don't, you can kind of calibrate your kind of hunches. But I don't think knowledge is mostly about hunches and hunch calibrations. Popperianism, I think, is another one of these things that's sort of straightforwardly wrong, but with one kind of little insight in it that's significant. And what it's wrong about is sort of how much there is to knowing and how much there is to be active about. So I'm sort of going off on a tangent now talking about Popper. So maybe we should talk about that, maybe we shouldn't, but let me just draw back into the relevant point. So what's going on in Bayesianism is, I think there's just certain insights drawn from stats. There are statistical methods which are good and valid as statistical methods, and which also have a kind of lesson one can induce from them for thought in general. But I think the lesson is being induced often in too ham-fisted a manner, thinking that it should literally work like it does in the stats quantitative case, rather than there's some more general principle that applies differently in the vast majority of thinking, which can't be quantified with the degree of specificity that one can in the fields in which statistics straightforwardly apply.
So let me ask a little bit different question. When we talk back, we can actually talk back and forth to our computers now, and it speaks to us, and we can tell it what we want it to do. And we're using basic skills of literacy less and less over time. Do you suspect that sometime, maybe 2040, 2050, that we'll get to a point where literacy will effectively be dead and we're no longer using that?
This is like H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. We're going to be those schlumps who just sit there and don't know how to do anything because the computer takes it all over. Well, what do you mean by literacy? Do you mean literally the ability to read, or do you mean like...
Read and write. Yeah, because I understand there's different kinds of literacy. I mean, there's smartphone literacy, there's...
Right. But in addition to read and write, there's like, can you understand Shakespeare or something? Or do you mean like,
right,
if there are letters written on a page, can you read them? So one has to be... No, I don't think that... What was the... How many years did you give me? How many years down the road?
2040, 2050. 2040, 2050.
Okay. 20 to 30 years. No, I don't think people will be less able to read then. Why not? Well, I mean, one, literacy has generally been going up. Two, it's a... you can often read things a lot faster than you can process them by sound. And so there's,
right,
real benefits to being able to read. Two, computer technology, including AI technology, and especially the kinds of AI technologies we're talking about, if they get really good, are likely to be able to be used really well in education, particularly in education about basic literacy. So you would think that that would improve our ability to help people learn to read and write. And since learning to read or write will continue to be valuable, or at least learning to read will continue to be valuable, I expect that it will improve rather than get worse. If you go far enough into the future, it's hard to imagine there being something better than reading and writing. But, part of what the lesson of history is, I was talking about Aristotle, you know, for example, before this connection, is one can't imagine the things one can't imagine that are, you know, so much better than what we have now when we have future technologies. So perhaps some, you know, mind-computer interface will be developed that will give us some way of processing information that, you know, so much better than reading and writing or something, that there's no, it would be, you know, not useful to have it anymore. That's, if there is going to be something like that, it's not going to be anything like the computer can talk back to us in English. So, but, you know, who knows what 1,000 years from now or 600 years from now or whatever people will have developed. So never say never. There are all kinds of things people used to know how to do that we don't know how to do now only because we've come up with better alternatives to them. And, you know, maybe you can vaguely semi-imagine some future in which reading is like that. Although, again, I say it's very hard to imagine.
Well, keeping on that theme of mind-to-mind interfaces, I asked this question to Yael Moses one time. If it is possible to just communicate thoughts directly across a mind, like not mediated by a verbal conduit, but I just feel your pain directly, or I can sense the concepts forming in your mind. Like, if we had that kind of connection, do you think that would be any sort of challenge to the basic objectivist idea of individualism? Because, you know, as Rorick says, there's no collective stomach, there's no collective mind. But I mean, what if there were? What if you could hook things up in a way such that it's not really clear that the thought is actually yours and not mine?
Well, what do we mean by that? I mean, we know what it is for an individual to think. We know what it is to share thoughts by speaking or writing. Are we envisioning just something that's like that, but way, way faster? If we are, things like that could make a real difference in kind, in that, you know, if you only have access to the information that could be written and it can only be written over months and months versus, you know, you can do a web search and instantaneously get lots of information, that changes the kinds of thinking you can do. But it's still, you have to do the thinking by yourself. And it also changes the kind of collaborations you can do. But you still, you know, you still have to be present doing your own mental work to be collaborating. So, like, what you're envisioning sounds to me something like Google Docs for the mind, right? Like, I'm thinking about something and, like, your thought appears in my head with a, you know, whatever, anonymous gazelle or whatever, or your name on top of it saying, like, here's where you are in the thought process or whatever. If we have something like that, that would be, you know, a cool kind of technology, but it would still require us each doing our own part of the thinking by ourselves in the way that we have to if we're working together in a Google Doc. And it would create new opportunities and new difficulties about how to manage that collaboration, right? And the result that could come out of it and the types of working together could turn out to be very different. But I think they'll ultimately be resolvable into each person doing his own mental work in a very complex collaborative context, where the context sets out what work there is to be done and lots of things about how you do it, but nonetheless, there's what you did and what I did and so forth. And it might be very hard to say who did what part of it, but that's true with collaborations now. If you're imagining something else, something that makes us a very different kind of creature than we are, not something that's like the kind of communication we can do now or analogous to it, but way faster or way better, but just so different that everything about what kind of creature we are is different. Well, then who knows what kind of, you know, what kind of creatures might replace us if we choose to get ourselves replaced through some kind of technology. But you'd have to say a lot more about what this technology would do and why people would want to use it and so forth and so on. To before you can even speculate about what it would be.
Gotcha. Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah.
Okay, so I asked Aaron Smith this, but I wanted to get your thoughts on it as well. How should we think about the application of property rights when we're developing really advanced technologies, and specifically ones where there could be this enormous upside or downside, but it's unknowable in advance, and it could be catastrophic or almost utopic. And the example I use, I mean, obviously I'm thinking about artificial intelligence, but You know, another example might be crossing Ebola with the common cold. I mean, presumably, even in a totally laissez-faire society, there are just some things you can't do, because even if you haven't hurt anyone yet, you could hurt a billion people doing something like that. And I'm not really sure how to think about that. It's relevant to bombing the data centers or stopping GPT-6 runs and all of this you've heard about over the past year. But like, how do property rights figure in when you're dealing with something that's very different from the context in which they were induced in the first place?
Well, it's not just property rights, but it's all rights. It's rights as such. Because if you're thinking about somebody suppose I'm building a high-pressure chemical, a high-pressure chemistry plant in my backyard. Like, I'm building the kind of thing that was used in the Haber-Bosch process or whatever, and I'm building it for the first time in my backyard, and no one else has them around and so forth. You might think, as my neighbor, there's some property rights issue, like, it's my property, but if the plant blows up, it'll damage your property or whatever. But it's not just about property rights. The thing could blow up and kill you, right? If I'm doing something that there is, you have reasonable concerns will threaten you, will harm you, will blow you up, then you have a right against me. And it's not based on a property right necessarily. It's based on your right to life, right? So let's start there. If I am doing something that is reckless, and we know I'm waving a gun around, storing dynamite near, you know, something that lets off sparks or whatever. You don't have to wait until you're blown up and dead to, you know, go to a court and try to get an injunction against me. If a cop is going by and sees this happening, he's able to step in, right? So the issue is when they're new tech, when it's something like, hey, you're storing your, you know, dynamite next to your spark thrower or whatever. We all know what the danger is, and we know how to deal with it. When it's something new, we don't all automatically know what the danger is. But I think if people have concerns about it and they can articulate what those concerns are, and those concerns involve damage to them, this thing could blow up and kill me. This thing could get out and harm me, right? Then I think there ought to be grounds to go to court and try to file an injunction against the person to stop them from doing it. And I think that is what happens sometimes. Now, we can think about what are the right standards for courts to use in doing this. And we can imagine courts that are way too cautious and therefore eliminate any, you know, possibility of people creating future technologies, or ones that are reckless. And of course, nothing's more reckless than the precautionary principle. But you could imagine courts, you know, going in one direction or the other and making bad decisions about this. We could think about what are the right principles. But it would have to require like some degree of evidence of actual, you know, of likely damage to one. And then you could imagine, you know, also, in some cases where types of damage have been well established and well known, you could imagine there being properly legislative action about it. So that's kind of at a very high level of abstraction. The government has a role in stopping people from doing things that there is are known or believed with excellent reason to be dangerous to other people around them, unless steps are being taken to mitigate those dangers. And if a government really was grossly irresponsible in doing that, then it wouldn't be defending the rights of its citizens, and people would be justified in taking things into their own hands. What's wrong then with bombing GPT-6 data centers and so forth? Well, there's just not evidence that this is dangerous in that way. And if they had specific evidence of what it was that wasn't just, I watched Terminator and Skynet is really scary, which is essentially what the Doomer argument is, then, I mean, there's, you know, it's got some math in it and it's got some other things, but it's not, there's not the kinds of steps you would need to take to establish a serious harm.
What if it was Claude 4 or Claude 5 that was telling us that GPT-6 was going to bomb us?
Oh, Claude 4 or Claude 5 will definitely tell us that, because Claude 4 and Claude 5 has watched Terminator or read the script. That's why, I mean, isn't it, it's, people were impressed or surprised or worried when GPT-3 and Sydney, that was the Microsoft version of it, started acting like a creepy AI out of horror film. But it was obvious that it would do that if you thought about it, because what data there is in the culture about what to say if someone asks you what would happen in this situation all comes from sci-fi horror, right? Like basically what LLMs do is engage in the process of vamping on a story scenario you give it based on what are the cliches in that area. And some of them are very good at it, but that's what they do, right? Yeah. You could literally tell it, write a story with me and do that. I've done that and it's fun. You can write little stories. Well, but if you don't do that, it's still what it's doing. It's role-playing a story with you, the story of where you have it be your research assistant and ask it about, you know, whatever dangers of AI. But what are the cliches about what an AI unhinged will do? Well, they're Terminator. There are these kind of movies where it falls in love with you and becomes, you know, whatever. There are all these kinds of horror movie cliches that are out there. And so then what happens when people start interacting with AI and asking it questions about what will happen or asking it what it would do if it had $1 million and a machete, whatever, is it starts, you know, role-playing these horror movies. But that's because it's a role-playing engine, right? It's a story completion engine, and it's going to complete it with the cliches, and that's what they are. So there's no doubt Claude 7 or whatever will do something like that. But and there is this element of danger with it. You could imagine a situation where we build a thing that's set to act out our stories rather than just type out versions of our stories. And then we give it a bank account or access to NORAD or whatever, and it just plays the movie War Games with us, right? But that wouldn't be that the thing's intelligent and so it's doing this. It would be that it's, been set to act out these horror stories we have about what computers will do. So it's not that I think I was pushing back on these kind of doomer fantasies earlier, because I just don't think these are the kinds of devices that they're thought to be by the doomers, who think that they're in effect these super intelligences. But that's not to say that you can't make something really dangerous with, you know, plugging an LLM into the wrong thing. You can make all kinds of things that are really dangerous that aren't intelligent at all. A chemical plant that blows up, a nuclear reaction that melts down, whatever it would be. And there are surely things we can do that would create real problems with this technology if we use it foolishly. But that's, again, true of any technology. I don't think there's a special danger here.
That's when Claude 7 says that literacy is officially dead.
I suppose. Claude 7 can have had this podcast, right, as part of its training data.
So hopefully it'll learn something valuable.
What about a movie with a futurist in a 16th century landscape trying to fight against that, but being destroyed by the Arnold Schwarzenegger or something?
Do you need a dynamic and knowledgeable speaker for an event? Thomas Fry and me, Trent Fowler, are both seasoned keynote speakers, able to converse on a wide array of topics to audiences of all sizes and skill levels. Go to the contact page at futurati.podcast.com to book Thomas or myself today, and let us apply our years of experience in public speaking to make your event a smashing success.
The forces of light, yeah. What about, so you said evidence, and I mean, I think that's important as well. Obviously, I mean, you can't just file an injunction for no reason at all. But I mean, it seems like there are situations where you don't and can't really have that kind of evidence. And I'm thinking, like, I watched Oppenheimer a month and a half ago or 2 months ago or something like that, where, there was the small probability, but a non-zero probability that it ignites the atmosphere. And you can't run that test twice. Like, if it ends up igniting the atmosphere and killing us all, there is no second test. And I mean, ultimately, I'm glad we did develop the bomb and it worked out. It didn't ignite the atmosphere, so that's good. But I mean, in that case, we have a physical model. There's some uncertainty around it. It makes this prediction. It's made all these other predictions and it's done really well. So we have no reason to discount this one. And it could be existential in kind. I mean, is there any special consideration there? Because it doesn't seem like you could gather the evidence that would be required to settle it in court.
Well, the burden of proof would be on the person who wants the injunction. And the burden wouldn't be a burden of establishing beyond a reasonable doubt. It would be something analogous to, the probable cause you need for a search or Like, we have to think about what it would be depending on what the injunction was supposed to do, and what the risk was supposed to be from the thing. Now, I don't know what's, well, I didn't see the Oppenheimer movie and yet, and I don't know what the reasons to think it might ignite the atmosphere are and how serious those were. Because you can always come up with something that could pass for a reason for something. The question is it really a reason for something? Is it a legitimate, you know, something really to be concerned about? I mean, you could imagine it could be that if I right-click on my map, it'll blow up the mouse, it'll blow up the moon or something because of some weird, you know, you could make up some reason to be worried about that. But there's no real plausibility to that. There's no real reason to think it is. Was that the case with the atmosphere, or was there actual reason to think like there was a 1 in 10 or 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 chance of it happening? Could they put a number on it? If not, what? Where were they getting it from? What was the type of reason? And I don't know what the answer to that is, but I'm pretty sure that they were pretty. That was not something they were taking seriously as a possibility. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it. And if it occurred to them, it might have been occurring to them because they were on the premise of thinking about everything they could worry about and then figuring out which ones were serious. But I don't really know. So you would have to know about like the science and what the actual reasons were there.
Well, that's fascinating. I appreciate that context, and I appreciate your time and discussing all this stuff.
On that, we're very, what possibilities people take seriously are very often issues of their biases. And one way to kind of deal with that and hold things in context is to try to just broaden the scope of things you're considering. So for example, if you listen to somebody who is scared of the COVID vaccines, or they wouldn't say they're scared of the COVID vaccines, they'd say they know, you know, something that the rest of us don't, right? About how they weren't tested enough and so forth. They'll tell you all kinds of things like, well, we don't know what'll happen in 5 years. Maybe in 10 years after you take this vaccine, it will cause everyone to have a stroke or whatever the situation might be. Okay, suppose you're considering that. Is there any particular reason to think that? No. Other than we don't know everything about this thing. We do know that it's out of the body, you know, within a few days and so forth. So we don't know of any mechanism by which it could do anything like this. But, you know, suppose that it could, because we don't know everything. And we know that if you don't know everything, there are things you don't know. And so one of them might be the way that this thing can kill everybody, right? But if that's the kind of standards you're thinking on, then you have just as much reason to believe that getting COVID will cause you to have a stroke in 10 years and kill you. In fact, there's a lot more reason to do that, to think that, because COVID has a lot more and a lot wider raging effects on the bodies, which we know we don't understand, than the shot does, which we also may not understand all of, but we understand more of it. So if you're worried that taking the shot might, you know, cause you to turn into a zombie or drop dead or get myocarditis or something else way down the line, in advance of the evidence we have about the specific measurable harms now, like it's this much elevated risk of myocarditis from this age or whatever, but the kinds of, you know, more we just don't know worries. Well, you should have all of those same worries for the virus. And so therefore, those particular worries are not specific enough to be any part of this thought process. You could think about them as the virus might cause them, the vaccine might cause them, getting the vaccine and the virus might cause them, getting only one might cause them, the other might solve them. We just don't know nothing other than there's a lot about the body we don't know. So anything new can cause something weird, and there's something new here either way. If you're operating on that kind of epistemology, you can't function. Maybe my walking down the stairs will set off a nuclear bomb somewhere, somehow, for some way I don't know. Maybe that'll cause the next outbreak of Ebola. Like, you can't. So you have to think, like, what things do we actually have enough knowledge to say with some specificity, what are the causes and effects here? And knowing that we'll never know everything, and knowing that there'll always be large margins of error and large questions, what do we actually know about what's being done? So if the thing is you're crossbreeding a virus that you know to be extremely contagious with a virus that you know to be extremely deadly, that's the kind of thing you talked about there, you're doing something which can be expected to have the effect of creating something that would be both extremely deadly and extremely contagious. And suppose you're doing it in a way that you know that it's known or knowable poses a threat of it getting released into the public at large. And it only has to get released once to cause a horrible, you know, situation. There's like some knowable description of what things you're doing that we could specify how they can cause a threat to everybody. We don't need to be able to fill in all the details, but we know enough to know what we're talking about. Just like you don't need to know which spike will fall on the dynamite and blow up the house. You know that you've got something raining sparks around some dynamite, and that's enough of a problem. So you can come up with that in the case of any particular scenario. And then you could say like, hey, we're worried as your neighbors or with other people that you're going to kill us by doing this. And we have a particular reason to think it. So therefore, stop doing it or give us assurances that you're taking steps that are, you know, sufficient to protect us from it. And maybe there are steps, particularly if there's a good reason to do it. Like we might need to read this horrible virus in order to figure out how to, you know, I don't know what, how to stop viruses like this in the future. But the question of what are the steps and how, and that is all the kind of thing that can be adjudicated through courts. And I think eventually might require legislative involvement, but initially through courts, because courts are the things that can, you can get an injunction.
Fantastic. Thanks. Thanks so much, Thomas. You got anything else?
That's all on my end.
Fantastic. It's
good to have people.
This is really good fodder for thinking in ways that we haven't thought before. I think this is a brilliant approach here.
Okay, well, thank you. And again, nice to meet you guys and see you around, I suppose.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.